much, all of you, for being here. Especially thank you to Mike for inviting me and making this visit possible. I've avidly been following the work of the REC Collective since I met Mike and Sheree at the conference in Birmingham a couple of years ago, and so I can't think of a better audience for my work in progress. And as Mike mentioned, my first book was about the period running from about 1870 to 1930 in Latin America, which represents the kind of high point of export-led modernization, which Latin American countries become integrated into global markets on the basis of the export of a handful of commodities. And I read how literature, both on the levels of content and form, tries to register that experience, which of course is a disaster for Latin American nations. It has remained in the imaginary, in the literary imaginary, I think up until today, the experience with that. So what I'm trying to do in this new project, from which I'm going to be presenting today, I became very interested in the period that follows export-led modernization, which in the Latin American historiography is called import substitution industrialization. And as I began to read and think about that period, I began to realize that the recalibration of the relationship between rural and urban areas was absolutely key to how import substitution industrialization functioned as a mode of accumulation. And so I got really interested in rural literature, which is a mainstay of Latin American fiction until about the 1970s, and I'll talk about that disappearance later on in the talk. And I'm mainly interested in the way in which that literary tradition is usually interpreted as pre-capitalist, because it's peasant, because it's not urban, because it's not about wage labor. And so that's the kind of reading I'm interested in doing, is one that would look at the hacienda system, where it seems as if there's no modernization going on at all, or no accumulation going on at all. And when you read the literature, you find something quite different. So with that, I'll begin. The title of my talk is Unfinished Transitions, The Dialectics of Rural Modernization in Latin American Fiction. An alternate title for this event might be Rural Literature as World Literature. Okay. So to begin, a bit of homespun wisdom from the great landowner of Jalisco, Mexico, Pedro Páramo, the title character of Juan Rulfo's 1955 novel. Meeting with his lawyer, who has decided to leave town in the wake of the 1910 Mexican Revolution, Pedro Páramo says, I quote, "You lawyers have that advantage. You can take your patrimony everywhere, so long as you don't get your face smashed in." End quote. So a law degree, the landowner reasons, is a mobile form of wealth, in implicit contrast with land, which, as political economists have long noticed, classical political economists, is a fixed and non-reproducible source of wealth. So on the face of it, Pedro Páramo would like to free himself from the shackles of land and to carry his patrimony everywhere. But this interpretation is not entirely correct, for there is no small degree of cynicism in the landowner's words. The reason the lawyer had come to Don Pedro in the first place was in the hope of being awarded a tip after so many years of service. The landowner, who fully understands this expectation, disrupts it by responding not as a patriarch or as a feudal lord, but rather as a bourgeois individual, who, as Marx writes in the Grundrisse, I quote, carries his social power as well as his bond with society in his pocket. Hence we are faced with a paradox. The lawyer, the carrier of mobile wealth, according to the landowner, appeals to a system of favor, while the landowner appeals to bourgeois values that would free him from favor altogether. As part of freeing himself from the system of favor, Pedro Páramo says that he would like to free himself from the strictures of land ownership. But again, this is not quite true. At this point in the narrative, we already know that his large land holdings have been begotten precisely through the system of personal favor and violence to which his lawyer now appeals. Hence the revelation and the relevance of the end of the sentence to his lawyer, "You can take your patrimony everywhere as long as you don't get your face smashed in." Even when bourgeois values are announced and the impersonal relations of the cash nexus revealed, violence is never far behind. Yet the landowner's cynicism aside, there's a deeper truth lodged within Pedro Páramo's identification of the inherent advantages and disadvantages of land as a conduit for the circulation and accumulation of capital. For on the one hand, as noted, land is fixed and non-reproducible. But as the geographer George Henderson notes regarding agriculture, land is important because, quote, "capital needs blockages. It invests in them so that it has access to something corporeal through which to circulate." And then he says, this is partly what lies behind Marx's quip, that the true barrier to capitalist production is capital itself, end quote. And yet Pedro Páramo, in accordance with his own observations, seems to be unable to overcome his rootedness in the patrimony of land. He doesn't grow in influence in the wake of the Mexican Revolution. Rather, following, and there's a plot detail here, the townspeople refuse to mourn the death of his love, Susana, so he dictates their death. And in that moment, he turns to stone, in accordance with his name, Pedro. Right? The region of Comala, the town, becomes totally barren, and the townspeople themselves turn into the living dead. Right? Okay. So after Pedro Páramo dies, the townspeople turn into the living dead, who are encountered by the principal narrator, Juan Preciado, at the beginning of the novel. And the great stylistic innovation of Pedro Páramo, of course, is that as it advances, the reader slowly realizes that all of the people who speak in it are dead, including the narrator himself. And so Pedro Páramo can't move. He can't take his patrimony with him. Instead, he remains fixed to the land. So are the townspeople, who turned into the almas en pena, or the damned, who continue on in a state of living death in the present, in what amounts to a rural hell on earth. And while this hell seemingly belongs to the non-time of eternity, we might best locate its origins in history. Pedro Páramo is, after all, a product of the Porfirian regime, the late 19th century period of liberalism characterized by the opening of Mexican markets to foreign capital and the vast enclosure of previously communal lands. Right? And this is why even in other parts of the novel, Pedro Páramo is associated with modern commerce. He works in a telegraph office. He complains about not getting paid. So, but at the same time, in order for him to go on in advance, he doesn't become a merchant or an industrialist. He becomes a landowner. Right? This is not because there's something congenitally archaic about him. It's because that's where the opportunity for accumulation lies. Okay. So on levels of both form and content, Pedro Páramo, the novel, captures a dialectic between extraction on the one hand and abandonment on the other, which from the point of view of a dispossessed peasantry might only be apprehended as a never-ending hell on earth. In this regard, it is important to mention that Rulfo wrote his novel about rural hell on earth in the mid-1940s, long after the Porfiriato had ended, but also after the most radical phase of the Mexican Revolution had reverted large landholdings to communally held ejidos. But notably, the creation of the ejido system is entirely absent in Rulfo's novel, almost as if it had never happened. Instead, the landowner dies, bringing the whole town down with him. On the one hand, this eventuality might be interpreted as the figurative death of the great Porfirian haciendas with the arrival of the revolution. And yet, on the other hand, Rulfo's depiction of Comala's death in life perhaps gestures toward a new moment of rural modernization in post-revolutionary Mexico, as the countryside increasingly came to occupy the role of provider of cheap nutrients to industrializing cities. In Mexico, but in other parts of Mexico and Latin America as well, in the mid-20th century, the rural order subsidized urban industrialization, much in the way that colonial and tropical foodstuffs had subsidized industrialization in 19th century Europe. Food prices were kept low to keep wages in the city low, and resulting crises in the countryside pushed peasants to find work in urban centers like Guadalajara and Mexico City in an ongoing process of dispossession. So not quite dead and not quite living either, the people of Comala are the remnants or desiderata of uneven and always unfinished projects of rural modernization. Or as the great intellectual Carlos Monsiváis writes, the living dead in Rulfo's fiction should not be approached as folklore or as reflecting a particularly Mexican obsession with death. These are two frequent interpretations of the novel. Instead, he says, Rulfo cuts through, quote, the light of dense ideological mist that surrounds the rural world and permits us to glimpse and examine the real environments lived by those sentenced to a barely concealed genocide. So subject to never-ending waves of dispossession, the peasants or campesinos of Pedro Páramo languish, and I quote Monsiváis again, under the terrible weight of rules of the game imposed and sustained by others. So I began just now with this short discussion of Pedro Páramo as an introduction to the main issue at stake in this talk, and that is, how Latin American fiction written at the mid-20th century, a high point of concern surrounding land tenure systems and the so-called peasant question, can register the uneven dynamics of rural modernization within paradigms of peripheral capitalist development and accumulation. Now we'll soon turn to a discussion of the Chilean author José Donoso's 1967 novel Hell Has No Limits, a text that, like Rulfo's, is organized around the trope of rural hell. In turning to this trope, I offer the following hypothesis. Visions of rural hell emerge not so much from archaic or traditional elements of rural society, but rather from the continuous waves of dispossession to which rural people have been subjected under different projects of accumulation. So in turning to rural societies as sites of painfully and unending modernization, I'm inspired by materialist literary critics such as Raymond Williams, whose classic The City and the Country was perhaps the first to consider how literature about rural spaces cannot be disentangled from the dialectical processes that join rural and urban in a single, if uneven, and disjointed circuit. More recently, critics such as Frederick Jameson and Neil Lazarus have studied how the persistence of subsistence and or peasant regimes within industrial modernity allow us to examine the imprint of uneven development on literary texts, in center, peripheries, and semi-peripheries alike. For Jameson, the temporal disjunctures characteristic of high European modernism, for example, might be the formal expression of the persistence of peasant regimes well into the 20th century throughout much of Europe, and I'm quoting him. What we call artistic or aesthetic modernism essentially corresponds to a situation of incomplete modernization, end quote. A provocative thesis indeed. For Jameson, it is ultimately what Arno Meyer calls the persistence of the old regime, peasant in nature, that shapes the literary mode often assumed to be the consummate expression of industrial and urban modernity. Neil Lazarus, in turn, has helpfully pointed to the ways in which uneven modes of development register themselves in texts from Africa and Latin America, especially with regard to the side-by-side existence of wage labor and coercion, subsistence farms and factories, and so on. Or as the Rec Collective has put it, world literature is the literature of the world, capitalist world system, one and unequal, and always characterized by uneven patterns of development. So from this perspective, rural literature is world literature. And it is by no means accidental that the Latin American boom, the mid-20th century literary current credited with bringing the region's literature into the fold of universal literature, that bad universalism we talk about, right, is itself overly concerned with uneven modernization, and often in its rural agrarian guise. Miguel Ángel Asturias's magnificent novel, Men of Maize, narrates the incorporation of indigenous people into markets in 20th century Guatemala, a transition narrative that, viewed from a certain perspective, provides a baseline for a universal story of always unfinished transitions to capitalism. Carlos Fuentes' novel, The Death of Artemio Cruz, begins on the deathbed of a Mexico City industrialist, proceeding backwards in time to trace his emergence first from the battles of the Mexican Revolution, fought mainly in rural contexts, and going back even further to his birth on a banana plantation in Veracruz. Gabriel Garcia Marquez, in turn, inscribes his fiction within the dizzying rise and fall of enclave agriculture in coastal Colombia by way of the United Fruit Company, an experience of rapid capitalist modernization that serves as a direct inspiration, I would argue, for magical realism. Okay. And here, just let me say that I've mentioned all of these texts, and what I'm doing now is I'm trying to distinguish different rural agrarian settings. So I'm separating out the enclave, for example, of Garcia Marquez and, you know, literature about banana plantations from the rural hacienda complex, which in many ways produced for the market, yet was never as completely embedded in market structures, commodification, or at least the process was not as rapid as in enclaves. Right, so right now what I'm concerned about is the rural hacienda complex. Okay, but now let us turn to the problem of rural hell, a trope that emerges specifically to capture the temporal and spatial logics of accumulation in the hacienda system, typically managed by local landowners producing commodities for local markets and labored on by a dispossessed peasantry. So on the heels of my discussion of Pedro Páramo, I want to continue to examine the hellish dynamics of mid-20th century rural life through the Chilean novelist José Donoso's El Lugar Sin Límites from 1965, translated into English as Hell Has No Limits. So in Rulfo's proto-magical realist novel, characters speak from beyond the grave in temporally disordered fragments. José Donoso's novel, by contrast, is hyper-realist, focusing on a period of 24 hours in a small town poised on the edges of a large wine estate in Chile's Central Valley. Rulfo's Hell is conjured by the hot, windless plains of Jalisco, Mexico in August, while Donoso's version is signaled by the oncoming chill of winter in a dying town with no electricity. And while Rulfo's novel arrests the voice of dispossessed peasants, Donoso's focuses on the tragedy of would-be small property owners whose aspirations to autonomy and independence come up against the unpredictable directions taken by capitalist agriculture. The atmosphere of Hell Has No Limits, critics, as you might gather from the title, is suffocated and rendered bearable only by the presence of its main character, Manuela, an aging transvestite who has lived for 20 years in a now decrepit brothel in a town called Estación El Olivo. The novel opens when one Sunday morning, La Manuela awakens with a start to remember that Pancho Vega is in town. A year earlier, Pancho, a former peon on the nearby estate, had assaulted Manuela on a visit to the brothel, ripping her already tattered but prized Sevillana dress, like a flamenco dress. Over the course of the next 24 hours, Donoso uses Pancho's return, which La Manuela encounters with a mixture of dread and desire, as an opening onto daily life in Estación El Olivo. So we see Manuela going to the home of Ludovina, a former servant in the big house, in search of gossip and thread to mend her dress. We see Pancho in a humiliating exchange with the landowner who has lent him money to buy a truck. And Manuela's daughter, the madam of the brothel, as she dreams of the Wurlitzer piano she will buy once electricity finally comes to town. So the rich details brought out in Donoso's realist representations are always played out cruelly against a landscape that is relentlessly bleak and absolutely non-conducive to life. When the novel opens, Estación El Olivo has already entered into what seems like an irreversible decline. As we learn from different details, the age of the railway has passed, and a highway has been built and removed from the town, consigning it to isolation. Paradoxically, while the highway signifies mobility, for the inhabitants of Estación El Olivo, it equals fixity in time and space. This fixity is itself figured as a kind of hell. The origins of the novel's title are revealed in its epigraph, taken from Marlowe's Dr. Faustus, in a conversation between Mephistopheles and Faust. And it says, "Hell hath no limits, nor is it circumscribed in one self-place, but where we are is hell, and where hell is, we must ever be." End quote. Sorry. Now, this epigraph locates in a hell that has no limits, that moves wherever one goes, but it also establishes the problem of a rural hell from which certain subjects cannot escape. The most chilling confirmation of this inability to escape comes at the novel's climax, when after performing for Pancho and his brother-in-law, Octavio, at the brothel, La Manuela is brutally beaten by them and left for dead. And that's the end of the novel. I will return to the scene of Manuela's brutal beating. For now, I want to stress that the metaphorical hell depicted in the novel is framed by waves of uneven and complete rural modernization, a longue durée that can be glimpsed in the 24-hour period represented. So at first glance, the hell of Estación Olivo is a context that modernity has passed by, literally with the position of the highway. But the reverse is also true. Hell in Donoso's novel is figured as a context in which new projects of accumulation, and with them dispossession, can emerge. In order to develop this argument, it is necessary to discuss the social universe of the Chilean fundo, or latifundio, agricultural estate represented in the novel, which from different angles can either be seen in a process of decay or reconstitution, or perhaps both at the same time. The great social fact governing Estación El Olivo is the estate belonging to the local landowner, Don Alejo. Accompanied by four fierce guard dogs wherever he goes, Alejo is the godlike or diabolical figure whose influence extends as far as his seemingly endless vineyards. The continued pull of the landowner's patriarchal power is made startlingly clear by his relationship with Pancho, the character whose return to town frames the action of the novel. Pancho had been born on the fundo, the son of a cooper, although it is also suggested that he might be one of Don Alejo's many illegitimate sons, and he grew up as a helper in the landowner's house and playmate to his daughter. Pancho is able to leave the world of the estate by taking to the highway, becoming a truck driver in the nearby city of Talca. There, he marries and prepares to buy his own home, one of those with, quote, those houses that look all alike, but painted different colors so they don't look alike. So Pancho's dream of becoming what he thinks is a proper proletarian is an illusion, however, for it was Don Alejo who gave him the money to buy the truck with a loan, and it is Don Alejo who has the power to call him back to demand payment, as he does in a scene of intense humiliation and infantilization. So Don Alejo's fundo remains a bastion of patriarchal social relations, even as former peons like Pancho move away. At the same time, as in the case as we saw in Pedro Páramo, this patriarchal power coexists with bourgeois social relations. Don Alejo is a patriarch, but in keeping with the historical role of the Chilean landowner, he's also an agricultural entrepreneur. Likewise, the family estate has long been part of a wider system of capitalist relations. At one moment, for example, we see Manuela traversing a part of town where there is what she calls an antediluvian threshing machine, yellowed and rusted with urine and used as a plaything for children. The fact that the threshing machine is rusted and no longer in use leads to its identification by Manuela as antediluvian. But of course, no machine can be antediluvian. Instead, modernization has been going on long enough on the estate to produce its own set of ruins. The presence of the threshing machine, which is not used for wine production, might even point us to a longer history of wheat production in Chile's Central Valley after 1850, when it became an export crop to Peru and California. If we posit wheat production as a possible point of origin of modernization 100 years earlier on the state, the intensification of wine production already posits a second moment within longer waves of modernization. At some point, more land was given over to wine production, leading to a present landscape of vineyards as far as the eye can see. Don Alejo probably did not oversee the birth of wine production on his estate, but he did use his political influence to get a train station built in the 1940s, a high point of economic growth under regimes of import substitution industrialization in Chile and across Latin America. During this moment of expansion, Don Alejo was not content to remain a producer of wine for local markets. Instead, he wanted to build a town on the estate, constituted by small proprietors, in what is described in the novel as the parceling of the estate. Don Alejo's plan to parcel the estate is revealed in a pair of chapters that flash back to a moment, what was in retrospect a moment of hope and possibility 20 years earlier. These chapters hark back to the moment when Don Alejo has just been elected Senator of the Republic. La Manuela arrives on the train as part of a group of performers for a celebration at the brothel and quickly becomes friends with the madam. During the celebration, the madam tells Manuela of Don Alejo's grand plans, and this is the madam speaking. Now he's selling his lots here in La Estación, but I know him and I haven't fallen for it yet. That everything is on its way up, that next year he's going to break up a corner of the estate and he's going to create a town. He's going to sell model properties, he says, with easy payments. And when he sold all of the lots, he's going to get them to put electricity in the town. And then we're all going to go up like foam. So the madam displays a healthy skepticism toward Alejo's promises. She hasn't fallen for it yet. And indeed, none of what Don Alejo proposes comes to pass. The houses in Estación del Olivo are not model properties by any means. Instead, 20 years later, the town is constituted by a few broken-down houses with a train station that has been eclipsed by a highway built at a remove from the town, consigning it to isolation and immobility. Moreover, the small properties created from Don Alejo's estate never moved past the world of the estate itself. One house, for example, was sold to the husband of a former servant in the big house. The brothel, in turn, became a small property by way of a bet between Don Alejo and the madam, in which the latter succeeded in seducing La Manuela, the transvestite, right, under the watchful gaze of the landowner, an act that results in the birth of a daughter. Having sex in front of the landowner, of course, is not an easy payment option. And again, we are not entirely in the realm of bourgeois contract. but one of violently intimate and personal relations. And yet, even though this plan for parcelización, or parcelization, is born of and expressed through patriarchal social relations, its function is to modernize the state. Moreover, his attempt to dedicate part of his agricultural estate to the construction of model properties with loans made to would-be proprietors marks a project of diversification away from the land. Once Don Alejo's plan is put into effect, he will not only be an agricultural businessman sending wine to domestic markets, but also a real estate development and banker, providing credit to would-be small proprietors. Now, it is crucial, as the madam already says 20 years later, that Don Alejo's plan does not pan out as planned. Instead, the mobility that Don Alejo, together with the small properties created on his estate, has reached a standstill with the ill-placed highway. The problem of the fixity of land, that is, has been thrown into sharp relief, and has momentarily, at least, become a barrier to further capital accumulation. Right? There's no great town, no real estate market, and no electricity. This fixity is felt most acutely among the small proprietors of the brothel, which, aside from no longer having any customers, is literally sinking into the ground. But this is not the end of the story of land and accumulation in the novel, a point that is often missed in readings of the novel's depiction of the decline of the oligarchy in the face of bourgeois modernization. Now that the plan for the town has failed definitively, Don Alejo has another trick up his sleeve: to buy back the properties he had sold or given away in order to transform the land underneath the houses back into production as agricultural land. From one character, we learn that Don Alejo is planning to, quote, demolish all the houses and farm the land of the town, fertilized and rested, and plant more and more vineyards as if the town had never existed. Yes, I'm convinced that that is what he wants. Now, after he failed at this project to make Estación El Olivo a great town, as he thought when the highway was going to pass through the door to his house. And here, with a flash, we realize that just as Estación El Olivo was born out of agrarian modernity tied to the train and died of the unforeseen twists of a new model, the automobile and the highway, the space that constituted the town will be thrown back into the circuits of capital once more through a return to agriculture. The moment in which land was turned over to housing now gives way to a moment in which the soil resting underneath the houses has reacquired value as agricultural land. The next phase of modernization, that is not that of small property owners in a town, but rather that of capitalist agriculture on a reconstituted estate. Hence, the modernizing gesture is not, as we might expect, urbanizing, but de-urbanizing. It is not rooted in small properties, but in the reconstitution of the latifundio. And it is with reference to the return of agriculture as a strategy for accumulation that the novel's multiple references to vineyards acquire importance. Even before figuring out Don Alejo's plan, for example, one character says that, quote, El Olivo is no more than a disarray of ruined houses under siege by the geometry of the vineyards, which seemed poised to swallow them. Once we know of the plan to reconstitute the fundo, the temporal organization of the novel acquires added meaning, for the single Sunday in which the action takes place occurs in the immediate aftermath of the autumn wine harvest, in which an agrarian cycle has been completed. The closing of the harvest signals the beginning of a new cycle, in which the houses under the rested soil might be reincorporated into the production process. The short intensity of human life, the 24 hours, retrospectively, is framed within the longer rhythms of capitalist agriculture. And here I want to stress that even though the temporal organization of the novel is to some extent organized by nature, this framing functions not as a leftover of a traditional peasant past, in which the changing of the seasons, for example, could still be captured as a facet of social existence, but rather as a symbolization of the temporal scheme of capitalist agriculture, in which nature is harnessed to an intensified process of accumulation. Also, with respect to the centrality of wine production in the novel, it is crucial to note that the scene of Manuela's beating and probable death at the hands of Pancho Octavio occurs in the bramble on the edge of Don Alejo's vineyards, into which she vainly tries to cross in search of the landowner's protection. Her attempt is in vain, however, not only because Don Alejo's power as a landowner is in decline, as critics have frequently pointed out, but because the social logic to which the vineyards correspond is wholly indifferent to the fate of subjects like Manuela. Don Alejo's fierce guard dogs roam the recently harvested vineyards, restricting their protective capacities to property. What happens in the bramble does not concern them. And so the new social order prefigured in Hell Has No Limits is not simply one of decline and decay, but one in which a new strategy of accumulation, however tentative, emerges. Under this new strategy, small ownership becomes an impossibility, a term thrown into relief in the case of Manuela. She might have entertained the thought of becoming a property owner at a specific moment in time, but in the longer durée of Chilean modernity, this subject position is rendered impossible. And what I find striking about the resolution of Hell Has No Limits is that it prefigures a project of reconstitution of property relations following a modest reform of property relations, an oscillation that eerily prefigures, or collectively figures, the history of agrarian reform and counter-reform in Chile. Agrarian reform was initiated under the Christian Democrat government of Eduardo Frei between 1964 and 1970, mainly as a bulwark against the threat of communism in the wake of the 1959 Cuban Revolution, and then continued much more radically under Salvador Allende's Socialist Popular Unity government between 1970 and 1973. Now, with the 1973 coup by Augusto Pinochet against Salvador Allende's Popular Unity government, land reform was brought to an abrupt halt and reconverted into large landholdings. As many historians have shown, after 1973, most of these estates were not returned to their original owners, but to an emerging class of Chilean entrepreneurs, as well as to multinational agricultural conglomerates. Wine estates, in other words, were not always returned to the Don Alejos of the world, but sold by the Pinochet regime to agricultural conglomerates, which in turn redirected Chilean agriculture away from domestic production toward more lucrative export markets. Wine, but also luxury fruit and vegetable exports like cranberries, citrus fruits, and the like. Today, a Chilean wine estate is much more likely to be owned by a group like the Cocinos or by Gallo Wines than a resident landowner like Don Alejo. Now, Donoso, of course, could not have foreseen this great transformation in its specificity. But what he does see, I think, is a future in which a reform in the realm of property relations can be halted with counter-reform. And that even as landowners like Don Alejo enter into decline and die, land continues as an active site of accumulation. Now, I'm getting to the end of my talk, so I want to just briefly give a few pages on what happens after the 1950s and the 1960s with boom literature, in which rural projects of modernization figure quite prominently, to the moment after 1970s when it seems as though depictions of rural life all but disappear from Latin American literature, with very few exceptions. So after the 1950s and 1960s, the rural world gradually disappears from Latin American literature. Indeed, the boom generation to which both Rulfo and Donoso belong marks both the high point of formally engaging in complex responses to rural Latin America and its swan song. From the 1970s onward, Latin American literature has become increasingly, if not exclusively, focused on urban settings and characters, as if the rural world had finally disappeared, as if the rural world had finally disappeared altogether. On a very basic level, this shift dovetails with the mass deruralization of Latin America and other parts of the global south that took place beginning in the 1970s as a result of three main factors. First, increased mechanization and implementation of green revolution technologies, such as genetically modified seeds, pesticides, etc. Two, state and paramilitary-led anti-insurgencies directed against peasants and indigenous people in the context of the Cold War. And three, in the wake of Cold War anti-insurgencies, neoliberal economic policies structured fundamentally around land counter-reform and reprivatization, free trade agreements like NAFTA, and the financialization of agricultural commodities on a global scale. The result of these transformations has been dramatic. According to a UN report, while Latin America was until the mid-20th century a predominantly rural region, it is today the most urban region on Earth. Such a result Mike Davis warns us, should not be interpreted as people being drawn away from traditional rural areas toward opportunities in the city. Rather, what Davis refers to as today's planet of slums is a direct result of an unprecedented expulsion of people from the rural areas of the South. This is the latest wave of dispossession lived by people, to recall Carlos Monsiváis's words, destined to disappear. Now, of course, peasants have not disappeared from rural areas, and to assume so is perhaps to become complicit with the invisibilization of rural life under neoliberalism, an invisibilization that has been most powerfully contested by social movements led by indebted farmers in India, the MST in Brazil, the Zapatistas and other anti-NAFTA movements in Mexico. As Friedrich Engels wrote a century and a half ago, quote, "It will serve us not to wait until capitalist production has developed everywhere to its utmost consequences, until the last small handicraftsman and the last small peasant have fallen victim to capitalist large-scale production." End quote. Instead, the task before us is to examine the continued unevenness of regimes of accumulation across new spatial configurations, whether these be abandoned haciendas, agro-industrial soy fields, narco-corridors, mega-slums, etc. Just as the uneven and frequently cruel effects of rural modernization are registered in mid-20th century literature, the echoes of de-ruralization can be heard in contemporary Latin American fiction. I began this talk by citing Pedro Páramo's half-serious lament that he was unable to take his patrimony with him, that he was unable to transform fixed wealth into mobile wealth and hence overcome further barriers to accumulation. I interpreted this lament as one that highlighted the mixed and uneven character of development in 19th century Jalisco, Pedro Páramo as simultaneously feudal lord and budding bourgeois. At the same time, his lament highlighted the very real problem of capital reaching its limits in the soil, necessitating ever more mobile forms of wealth. In Latin American fiction after the 1970s, landowners seem to have been granted their wish, freeing themselves from the shackles not only of land, but of rebellious peasant labor, to become owners of mobile property, most notably in the realm of financial speculation. To return to the work of José Donoso, his 1976 novel, A House in the Country, an allegory of the Chilean coup against Salvador Allende, ends with a reactionary landowner family selling their rural estate to the gringo investors. In Arturo Fontaine's 1992 novel, also Chilean, entitled To Hear Her Voice, Oír Su Voz, the son of an oligarchic family that lost their land under the Frey land reform remakes his fortune in the deregulated credit markets under the Pinochet dictatorship in the 1980s. And in Horacio Castellanos Moya's novel, The She-Devil in the Mirror, members of El Salvador's infamous 14 families, a nickname for the tiny oligarchy that has dominated the country since the rise of the coffee export economy in the late 19th century. In this novel, they sell their coffee farms to invest them in what is essentially a Ponzi scheme. This pyramid scheme, in turn, opens on to a money laundering operation for the transnational narcotics economy. Now, the way Castellanos Moya stages the financialization of the Salvadoran oligarchy in She-Devil in the Mirror is significant. We will note to begin the continued reference to hell by way of the devil, or diabla, in its feminine form. This hell is not rural, but urban, namely the vacuous landscape of post-war San Salvador, lined with newly constructed malls and American chain restaurants whose parking lots are filled with the SUVs of the rich. The novel unfolds as the paranoid interior monologue of an upper-class woman, Laura, whose best friend has been murdered in her home by a former paramilitary operative turned professional hitman, which may or may have not been set up by another member of the oligarchy. We never know if the crime is never solved. In this neoliberal context, the landed oligarchy engages in predatory asset stripping. Land sold to transnational agro conglomerates is transformed into fictitious capital, a shift in turn buttressed by the massive influx of monetary remittances from migrant workers who were themselves pushed out of El Salvador because of the Cold War counterinsurgency. Right. What is interesting in She-Devil in the Mirror is that the neoliberal logic of asset stripping extends into the core of the oligarchic class, as it begins to cannibalize itself as they compete against each other for new windfalls. The resulting vision of the world is one that is unmoored from reality and totally paranoid. There's a gendered aspect here, too. I won't have time to talk about it. If in old times the landowner is the patriarch, right, this ultra-masculine figure, in at least two or three novels, the ways in which the unmooring of the landed oligarchy is figured in fiction is through a crazy woman of that class. Right? Okay, we can talk about that later. Okay, but would that the only consequence of de-ruralization were the self-cannibalization of the ruling class. Alas, that is not the case. As other recent novels, such as Roberto Bolaño's monumental 2666, focus on how neoliberalism cannibalizes the reserve army of workers produced by de-ruralization in the neoliberal era. The center of 2666, as many of you already know, is occupied by a town very much like Ciudad Juárez on Mexico's border with the U.S., where hundreds of female factory workers have been murdered, raped, and left in the desert since the mid-1990s. All this happening in the wake of the 1994 free trade agreement known as NAFTA. The maquila industry, of course, was built on what has been perhaps the biggest wave of de-ruralization in Mexico to date. NAFTA allowed subsidized agricultural products to flood national markets, putting rural producers out of business, many of these expelled rural workers, finding new work either in the maquila sector. On the other hand, the recent explosion of narco economies cannot be separated from this mass expulsion from the countryside either. So in the excruciating middle section of 2666 that deals, again, hell, right? Yeah. 666, we have this again. Post-rural hell. That deals with the mass murders of women factory workers, whose most chilling section read as police reports, we learn that some of them come from rural areas, such as Oaxaca and Michoacán. Many more, though, can't be identified at all. For example, I quote from Bolaño, the first week of April, the body of another dead woman was found on the open ground east of the old rail sheds. The dead woman had no identification on her except for a card without a photograph certifying her to be a worker at the maquiladora Dutch and Rhodes, end quote. This identity turns out to be fake, meaning that we don't know anything about her whatsoever, neither her hometown or even the corporation that in the other case of the other woman has taken over her identity. And we need not romanticize rural origins or a rootedness in land to identify the process of utter destruction through which dispossession is wrought in the current era. In Bolaño's novel, we are faced with an aesthetic of exhaustion and waste, which, as Sherry Deckard writes in dialogue with Jason Moore, quote, the desert dump full of both literal and figurative human waste is the site of the non-value produced in relation to the surplus value extracted in the assembly plant. And the desert drained of water is the site of extra human nature from which free gifts have been exhausted. End quote. So to conclude, the transformation of landowner into financier and money launderer, and formerly rural workers into industrial waste, form what I think are two sides of a similar coin of de-ruralization. To recall Juan Rulfo's language in Pedro Páramo, these are the new murmurs, murmullos, of post-rural life, a historical transition that today remains unfinished. Sure they do. I haven't studied them yet, so this is why this talk focuses mainly on two literary works, and I think this speaks to my method as well, that might be useful to talk about. I find that it's only through close reading of literary texts that I can understand how literature maps the unevenness of the world system. Yeah. So let me think a little bit more about which other tropes we might find. I mean, the way that I'm organizing the book now is through a rereading of literature produced between the 1930s and the 1960s, mm-hmm. mainly. And so the trope of rural hell is the one that I've found most powerful so far. So more helpful. There's very little Latin American literature that's translated, or Spanish American literature that's translated. And right now, I mean, every text that I cited in this talk has been translated into English. But I think precisely on the wave of interest generated by the boom, whereas texts from the 20s, 30s, 40s can be very interesting, just aren't translated. So are you asking whether these novels, these more recent novels, are more or less translated?
It depends on what corpus you chose, because did you choose examples of text, just for texts that have been translated?
No.
Because then obviously the picture is very different to like what kind of tropes emerged, like because you choose them essentially.
Yeah, I generally begin with the Spanish. I begin with my corpus, and then, you know, for talks like this, I find the translation. I was able to find translations for all of these, which I think speaks to, you know, the rapid translation of contemporary Latin American fiction into English, at least by these major writers that I'm working with. Of course, there's many texts that haven't been translated.
Well, thank you very much, Erika, for a wonderful talk. I was just thinking if I could push on this discussion to talk about things that are interesting for me. Mm-hmm. Maybe we could say, well, I don't want to do that. But I think you do want to do it. So it's like that. How can we think the boom of Latin American literature? I mean, what are the conditions of possibility for this boom? You know, I was thinking in terms of the coincidence of the boom of Latin American literature with also with the beginning of discussions of world literature. And, you know, all paranoid fantasies cross my mind. You know, one thing that repeatedly crosses my mind is that it has to do with the centrality of Latin American repressive regimes for the Cold War, mm-hmm. right? I mean, without those regimes, what would have happened to the Cold War, we think, right? So have you ever thought of, you know, all of a sudden, you know, those northern countries that had never looked into our culture, mm-hmm. into our cultures, except to talk about it, how exotic they were, or like somebody was mentioning Frida Kahlo the other day, right? So how come all of a sudden everybody wants to talk about Latin American magical realism and as a style, as a way of writing, it becomes all over. I mean, Salman Rushdie copies it. Sorry, I don't know if the word is copy. Maybe copies it in Midnight's Children, right? So it's a novel that could have been written by Garcia Marquez if he were Indian, right? So I don't know. Am I making myself clear?
Yeah, of course. I think there are lots of different ways an answer could go. I mean, one of the first things I would say: what are the conditions, the historical conditions of possibility for boom literature in Latin American countries themselves, mm-hmm. before answering the question, what is it about boom literature that metropolitan readers like? Right, so I'll separate those two, I think.
That's a very clever way of doing it. I can see why you do it.
And the reason I'm doing this is, you know, a lot of people I've read cite Perry Anderson's really kind of interesting discussion of when, for example, a society is faced with revolutionary possibility, that radically new literary forms can be generated. And I think that's Latin America in the 1960s, without mm-hmm. a doubt. So I think there's something about that moment that allows for this. Now, again, you have novels that will be called the pre-boom, which that's something I hate. Let's just, you know, they're fine, they're booms. But at least that's the question of the 1960s. I want to start to argue, and I haven't quite fleshed this out yet, I think there's something fundamentally happening about the reorganization of material life that has to do with, for whatever reason, the visibility of uneven and combined development registers itself in such a way that it's able to be captured by these texts. Mm-hmm. That's something I'm working on. Now, the other part of the question, why does boom literature become so attractive to European and North American audiences and you know, chronically misread by them, right? as being about folklore and local color and all the rest of it.
Or for being about magical, right? Right. Just no magic.
The persistence of pre-modern thought, right? Which is all, I think, bullshit, right?
Yeah.
But Franco Moretti, I think, has a good enough interpretation in his book on world epic, in which he writes that, you know, it's for European audiences a kind of, again, to go back to the question of revolutionary possibility, a recuperation for themselves mm-hmm. of that possibility, or of the possibility also of a so-called innocence in the misreading of, you know, the scene of the ice in 100 Years mm-hmm. of Solitude, that that's this like moment of, wow, everything can be new again, right? Mm-hmm. And then there's another part that I would add is the South-South reading of the boom, which I think is fascinating and is harder to track. But, for example, I know that Asturias became wildly popular in Turkey.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Because I think he captures something that's a historical process that's happening in Turkey. Also, which is
Pamukki, then,
which is the you know, the
and Pamukki goes on to write magical realism.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then you end up having Rutilio Deakin's first big.
Can you can speak up, please?
Realist novel.
Sorry, I can't hear you.
I said you then have Latife Tekin's first big magical realist novel, Regi Kristen, which is about Shantytown, is about de-ruralization, and is definitely looking to Asturias and Latin America for models.
Right.
Yeah. Looking at the period of the 50s and 60s of de-ruralization in Turkey. So
right. Which is another entry point into the question of rural literature as world literature, right? And how there's a capturing of an experience of modernization that might be more prevalent than the, you know, the one that happens in 19th century Northern Europe and North America, for example.
As you're speaking of that, do you think there are fruitful comparisons to be drawn with other experiences of rural modernization, as captured in literary texts, so for example, in China and India and so on and so forth?
I certainly hope so. I don't know those corpuses. So tell me.
Why we need to talk. It's just something that I thought would be interesting to explore.
Yeah, of course. Cool. And I think that's, you know, this is one of the benefits of knowing a tradition really well, is that you start to make connections, but then you can easily, I don't know if the same person can make those deep connections. I think that has to be collaborative work, in my case at least, because I don't know anything about Chinese literature. I would love to know.
Thanks so much, Eric. I've got lots of questions, lots of people who make some talk. I wanted to ask how this fits into the narrative of the Latin American history canon, because I find them really frustrating. They're very teleological. So you go from the movement, the boom, to the post-boom, which is parallel to modernity, post-modernity, which is parallel to the state, to the market. Mm-hmm. And how does this then mix up those narratives and provide more complex readings of texts?
Yeah.
I would also wonder how we could find a different reading if we're reading it through non-canonical, non-male writers.
Yes, I'd love to hear.
These are very famous masculine dominant writers. And lastly, what would you make of the kind of return to the rural in lots of contemporary writers, which is a thing you see in Latin American cinema as well? Mm. So say, one paradigm would look at kind of the neoliberal supermarketization and the urban in the 80s and 90s, but then how in lots of contemporary films and literature you get this return to the rural, and how does that fit then into this narrative?
Okay, thank you. The question about literary periodization, I agree, it's very tedious and boring. I start from there because that's the field in which I'm writing. So what I do typically as part of my methodology is that I say, okay, this body of works we've always talked about is regionalism or criollismo, right? But what's really going on in this genre? I think that's a first step that's necessary to be able to then leave that periodization. And then about your second question, non-canonical and non-male texts, yes, you're absolutely right. I mean, I worked with these texts for the purposes of this talk because I thought they would be the most that people would have read them. But you're absolutely right. No, I can't only study, you know, the boys club that is the boom. There's a very interesting Chilean author from the 1940s, Marta Brunet, who writes about the kind of the forest frontier in the south of Chile. It starts getting back in the 1940s, so she's someone I'm working with, for example. But yes, I think that has to be part of the focus. And then the question of the return to the rural, which works do you have
in mind?
For example,
Thomas Gonzalez, which has recently been translated, it's called Back to the Sea, I don't know the sign in English. You've got like Gioconda Belli in Chile, Luis Sepulveda, about the Patagonia and the kind of ecological crisis.
Yeah.
A lot of poetry, eco-criticism.
There's a song called Patagonia a while back as well. There's a film called Patagonia.
Yeah, there's a film.
Yeah, the Welsh.
There's a film.
I have to look at them. You know, I haven't considered that corpus, but I'd like, you know, for you to give me those examples. I'd have to, I mean, the way that I would read them would be then through the paradigm of de-ruralization to see how they register that or not. But, so I'm not...
I'd like to invite you to, you actually kind of hint a little in for a question on gender kind of the contemporary fiction. You noticed something. Obviously this is a work in progress, but to maybe hypothesise why there's this gender frame, this whether it's the narrative frame of the voice or the persona, but also just to... It reminded me of a discussion we had on the whole zombies, Kirsten's thing. And you began your talk by, you know, it's an animal of the undead, and then it shifts into the trope of hell on Earth, and you kind of leave behind that undead. And Kirsten's work, from what I understand of it, there's this thinking the world ecology through this trope of the zombie. For her, gender plays this really interesting role, and especially the figure of the particular version of the zombie, the hysterical female. It's interesting that seems to be one phase of the sugar frontier.
My argument about the zombies, and I think this very much reflects on the argument about fear of the zombies, just called not to share about how we're persons. Anyway, is that the zombie is in a sense a kind of figure that encapsulates the relation between people and the land, and that kind of essential separation, and that also therefore has this kind of female articulation, of course, in the female zombie that is always sidelined now, right, that no one looks at. And the kind of female enclosures that you therefore also need to look at in conjunction with this kind of figure. And my argument, I guess, was it moves from, coming from the historical natures articulated in the sugar plantation to this kind of first kind of simplification to the kind of petro-modernity. So for me, the key date there in kind of how this is articulated in the zombie figure is 1968, Night of the Living Dead. And my reading is that it kind of registers this new moment when petrol is central to this reconfigured relation between the environment.
And where is this?
So this is Night of the Living Dead, and actually no one ever pays much attention to the fact that the petrol pump is so central, and cars are so central, and of course that the reason for that is also that it's kind of filmed in Pennsylvania, right, where this is the site of the emergence of petrol modernity. So there's this major shift that
That's great. Yeah, I mean, what are the murmullos, like the dead peasants, the living dead in Pedro Páramo? How could they be related to the figure of the zombie, which of course is a rural, comes from the rural world. Well, rural in a very special way. It comes from the world of the plantation, right? Mm-hmm. Historically, but to get back to the question of gender. There's several ways in which gender becomes crucial, and one is that you have a long symbolic association between women and land on one hand, but also women and finance, right? And so I found in the 19th century most texts about financial speculation and financial crisis are figured through women, right? And so I think that's happening. There's a recurrence of that in these texts that are about landowning families that become financiers, and then the way that shift is registered is through, and then not only is it a woman, it's a crazy woman. And there are at least two examples. There's the Castellanos Moya, but then there's this other novel called Delirium by Laura Restrepo, from Colombia, who's, it's about a crazy woman of the landed Bogota oligarchy whose family is becoming enmeshed in Pablo Escobar's financial, they're becoming money launderers for Pablo Escobar.
But she's the one who's crazy, right?
Yeah, exactly. And then what else was I going to say? Oh, and then on the question of labor, right? It's female bodies that become most visible in the wastification of neoliberalism because of the devaluation of work, I think is immediately feminized on one hand, and also because in reality it's women workers who have borne the brunt of structural adjustment in Mexico, but also other places.
It was Neil and then Stephen.
And thanks very much for a very suggestive talk, Erica. I had two questions, and they relate to each other, I think. The one is about what we have been talking about in some way, about perhaps the paradigm of de-ruralization, as you call it, in the post-boom period particularly, and how the rural, as you say, effectively disappeared. But it doesn't in certain significant cases. I mean, the one that I'm very interested in is, say, Argueta's Cuscatlan, for instance, which you can read that way. But it seems to me that if you're going to read a text like Cuscatlan under that paradigm, you have to raise another problem or another question, which is the problem of representation, which is to say the relationship between the author or even perhaps the narrator and what's being represented as this greater movement. And I didn't hear you talk very much about that problem, the problem of the writer in relationship to the material in what you were describing. Has there been a change in that relationship across the three periods that you've been looking at? Because that would be a very interesting question. Where do they stand now, who writes these sorts of texts? But then, just to open up that question of methodology, I think you give away the game too much if you say I start with close readings, because it seems to me that you don't. You do brilliant readings. But that's not the same as close reading in the way in which that category has come down to us. I mean, I think you precisely don't do close readings, because if you did do them, you couldn't do the work that you do. And I wondered if you would sort of consider. I mean, I'm thinking of the sort of subtitle of Moretti's work is Between Literature and History, and yours isn't so much about history, although of course it's historical. But there's something much more. The methodology that you're developing is actually much more intricate than that. I mean, you return your questions to text, don't you? You come to those texts with a set of questions which are not close reading. It's not at the level of stylistics that you're producing this analysis. So it seems to me the value of the work lies precisely in that, in your ability to find in the texts things which might have been findable outside by a political economist or a historian and so on, but maybe not. And that's what's so interesting, it seems to me, about the emphasis on the literature. You're making an argument for the specificity of literature here. But I think it's important for us, let's say, not to allow that to be entered under the rubric of close reading, because I don't know if you would agree with that.
I do. Yeah. For that clarification, I think when I said close reading,
attentive reading.
I did mean attentiveness to the text.
Yeah, yeah.
And I mean that in that, implicit contrast with distant reading. Although I'm very, very, very. Amenable to Moretti's designation of a field of world literature, field of the world system, all the rest of it, where I part ways is with the abandonment of the text. Because there's no way I could have a reading of how Chilean literature understands, modernity, modernization in the world can be de-ruralizing and de-urbanizing. It can de-urbanize and go back to the rural. I never would have known that had I not done
found
an attentive reading of the text. So I actually find that literary texts, I put them at the center of being able to provide insights into processes of modernization that we wouldn't get anywhere else. So yeah, thank you for that clarification. I think you're absolutely right. And about this, the question of representation, why are certain authors able to write in a certain way about the rurals and others not? I mean, the first observation I would make is, you know, where were the boom authors from, right? Juan Rulfo is the son of a landowner from Jalisco. Gabriel García Márquez is from the kind of petty bourgeoisie of a ruined banana enclave. Mm-hmm. José María Arguedas is the son, the mestizo son of a landowner. Mm-hmm. But then in the next generation, the post-boom generation, that simply doesn't happen anymore. Mm-hmm. I'm not aware of any contemporary Latin American writer who is the son of a resident landowner, right? Because I think that social structure has disintegrated to such an extent that that's not possible, right?
Yes, it does, absolutely.
And I mean, writing has always been urban in its impetus in Latin America. That's maybe something I should imagine, right? There's not a lot of writers who grow up in rural areas in the 19th or early 20th century and write from rural areas and never leave them, right? I mean, it's always like Efraín Cristal writes, the Andes viewed from the city, right? But what usually happens in standard criticism is that we generally think that the writer is the person who brings the modernity to the context, right? And what I'm trying to show here is that it's the processes of modernization are there, and the author is able to see that. But Kutikan is a novel. When is that? Is that from the 80s?
I think the late 80s.
From the 80s, right? Yes, yeah. Right, yeah. Right. But that would be a good text for me, too. Yeah.
Thanks for a really great talk. I wanted to ask a question about something, whether you thought this was useful or not. And it has to do with the closest reader I know, and that's Richard Godin. He's like closer than close. I'm going to try to summarize his argument in two sentences. Richard's word to recognize how difficult. But he has, in his book, From Vincent and P. Faulkner, An Economy of Complex Words, he has an argument about how at the language of word choice and lapidary sentence, why Faulkner writes the way he does. And he says it comes from a particular kind of crisis for the southern landowners in the roughly the 1930s, the Depression era, where they've lost the Hegelian master-slave dialectic, which is the former slave population is either leaving the land to go up north or has their own sort of small lands. At the same time, the cotton crop is failing, and the only way these farms can survive is because the northern federal government financially subsidizes these farms, which is a psychological crisis for the remnants of the Southern Confederacy, who now find that the only way they can maintain the mythology of Confederate life is by accepting financial aid from Yankee capital. And that these, this loss of the black slave population and the forced safety net of the North creates a kind of psychological crisis of, he doesn't use the phrase combined and even development, but I'll help him out here. And that this actually explains at the level of words, what he calls complex words, and the ambivalence or deconstructive quality of the words, is that this historical crisis drills down even to the level of the words. And I was wondering if that kind of narrative about a sort of landowning elite, crisis of landowning elite, is useful to what you were describing.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, the reading we usually, and again, I mean, Pedro Páramo Rulfo is another author who distills words, right? His Economy of Language, and that's not something I talked about now, which is most often read as, oh, you know, Rulfo is translating into universal literature, right, the grand themes of humanity through the voice of the peasant, right? And he was able to do that even though he was a reactionary landowner. So there's this very kind of weird and unsatisfying interpretation of that kind of peasant speech as high modernism, right? That's the most kind of common interpretation we get. But I think, yes, the argument could be made that distilling of language could have something, and I mean that would be a deeper reading and interpretation and distilling into form that I've been able to give here and that I've been able to arrive at yet. But I would be thrilled if I could find a connection between the economy of Rulfo's language, you know, the peasant speech, and a crisis in the larger political economy or the landowning class. What I would say is that Rulfo has lots and lots and lots of places in which he discusses the crisis of coming back to his hometown 20 years after not having been there, and finds that it's dead, right? It's a ghost town. So, but I'm not sure exactly how I would make that link between, you know, something within the you know, something akin to the master-slave dialectic in which that relationship disappears and creates a new stage of language, but that's something I will think about.
Exactly the kind of work that I'm trying to do at the moment. We've got in G-O-D-D-E-N, it's Irvine, and it's called Faulkner, an economy of complex words.
Could I just tell a funny story about Richard Godden and his relationship with Stephen Shapiro, actually? Steve teaches this course, which begins with, and for years I've done this, with the Kondratiev cycle, you see. So he goes in, and students are bewildered that we're dealing with these 500-year cycles. That's seminar one. Then Steve was replaced by Richard for a couple of terms, and Richard insisted, he came in, and in the first week, the students were not allowed to talk about anything other than the first two words of As I Lay Dying. And secondly, it was the first sentence of As I Lay Dying. They were completely bewildered. They thought they were going in for a 500-year cycle. Instead, it was just two words at a time. But the interesting thing is that they meet in the middle somehow.
Which reminds me, I think it was Sartre who said that you can read the whole history in syntax.
Yes, exactly.
That's a wonderful phrase. Always warms my literary critic heart that I can read a whole history.
But
in
I never
syntax.
Know when you have to know the whole history first.
I think it's a dialectic. You don't know it, and then you know it,
yes,
and then
yes,
you know it
right.
In a different way.
I want to ask you a question about the visibility of literature, why Latin America might be this optic, which then, of course, there's dynamics of commodification and then there's ending out magical realism, but why is it so sort of hungrily received? And one of the reasons for this might be precisely because some place in Mexico was such a laboratory for the structural adjustment that followed. It was a laboratory
so was
for globalization, not just in terms of financialization, but the Green Revolution, the ways in which the trials of agriculture, the importation of this total reorganization of land, not just in the terms of land as an ownership, as an, you know, the hero, but in how that land is used, how the soil is used, how oil, the Mexican oil, which is nationalized at the same moment that Pedro Páramo is being written,
yes,
right?
Yes.
That relation then enables the later text. And because of that, it's condensed. I think the way that's sort of mediated, the constellated and literate form, provides sort of optics on a larger world that then enables both this kind of south-south kind of conversations you're talking about, but also perhaps a certain, albeit often, misreception in the core, but might explain partly that dynamic.
Yeah.
And might also explain trying to think the disappearing rural. But and in relation to that, I just wanted to say one more comment about the kind of, you know, the comment earlier about the stagist or kind of stadial, very teleological narrative of Latin American studies, which, you know, it's quite frustrating, but if Páramo, proto-magical realist, is they're not so hyper-realist, but they both have similar gothic, spectral, you know, diabolical figures. what does that say about periodicity rather than periodization? Especially what you're reading is a long durée of recurring moments of modernization, which are not the same because they're different phases, and you're also teasing out, I thought, really beautifully the difference between enclave and hacienda complex. But what does that do to the Latin American periodization and to the very notion of realism or modernism, which you, in a way, started off with? And I just think it can be incredibly suggestive, maybe, to challenge those categories as you go through, in the same way you're challenging the modernity and the periphery.
Exactly. No, and I think that would be an excellent next step, right? I mean, once I'm able to abandon that kind of straitjacket of periodicity and proto-magical realism and magical realism, right? And I can't get away with calling Rulfo a member of the boom and a self-respecting Latin American literary conference, right? Pre-boom, right? So, but I think that that's really great, Sheree. Thank you for that discussion of maybe that is the proper way to put El Lugar Sin Límites in relationship with Pedro Páramo is precisely through periodicity. And not through periodization. Yeah. And then that would mean understanding historical change in Mexico and you know the kind of modernization of estates in Jalisco in the 1940s or 1930s in tandem with modernization in the Central Valley in Chile in the 1960s, which is all available to us, right? And there's great historiographical work. But thank you.
Okay. We're